coming up in this episode.
They flee this community because Anne is worried that she's going to be killed for being a witch.
Or you had a single woman with money. She had a target on her back because it didn't fit the ideology of the time. But then waking up to this, oh, it's not just me. This is a system that is keeping me from getting what I want.
This podcast from Georgia Public Broadcasting highlights books with Georgia connections, hosted by two of your favorite public radio book nerds who also happen to be your hosts of All Things Considered on GPB. I'm Orlando Montoy.
And I'm Peter Biello. Thanks for joining us as we introduce you to authors, their writings, and the insights behind their stories, mixed with our own thoughts and ideas on just what gives these works the narrative edge. All right, Orlando, it's December, so what better time to talk about a horror novel?
Yeah, that was a few months ago.
No, it's now. It's definitely now. Are you a fan of horror novels?
Oh, sure. Yeah, I mean, I can do with a little gore and scare, but not too much violence.
No, okay. Are you a Stephen King fan, Anne Rice?
No.
Who are you thinking? Neither.
No.
Okay.
I really didn't read much books until this podcast, Peter.
That's a lie. That's a lie. Well, this month we're talking about some horror. It's a novel called Dark Sisters by Christy DeMeester. She lives in Dallas, Georgia. There's the Georgia connection for this podcast about books with Georgia connections. And her story's set in Atlanta of three different eras: the mid-1700s, the 1950s, and 2007.
That's a lot of ground to cover.
Yeah, it is. But she weaves it together in such a way so that it makes sense thematically. So all the women in these stories, because there's three different women, they're all living to some extent under the thumbs of the patriarchy, men in their lives, society, broadly speaking, sort of forcing them to be perfect wives, perfect mothers, and forcing them to suppress their true selves. So it ends up being that they're kind of pushed into these boxes that you might expect for someone in the 1950s. Of course, 1950s is a popular era for that, but all these eras.
So is the horror the blood and gore, or is the horror like the social conditions?
It's definitely the social condition. I mean, there is some gore. I wouldn't say that that's the scary part necessarily, but the constant fear of, you know, society finding out your true self, having to hide yourself, the pain that's inherent in that, that is kind of where the true horror lies.
All right. So we got the horror in society.
Yeah. But there is something to the gore element. And that is that, you know, let me back up and say that all of these women in this story are living in oppressive Christian communities. And so they have to suppress the natural desires that run counter to fundamentalist Christian groups. And when they do that for long enough, because of a curse that started in the 1700s, they start to get sick.
Okay, so the curse is the...
Yeah, the curse is the gore horror, right? Like, this is the thing that's lurking.
This is the Halloween stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
We want Halloween stuff.
So this is what comes close to the Halloween stuff. And I should say, too, that I don't love gore either. I don't think that's the most fun part of a horror novel for me. I like sort of the anticipation of seeing what's scary thing is around the corner rather than seeing the scary thing itself. But the scary thing here is this illness that women who suppress themselves too much eventually develop. And it's this illness where their teeth falls out and you can see the kind of gross stuff hanging from the tooth holes and there are boils in their mouth. It's gross. It's gross. And she leans into that a little bit. But it's not too much for me, which should say something. It's not gore porn necessarily.
Yeah.
It's just gore to drive home a point and really illustrate how awful that this particular illness is. Now, it's kind of related to the idea of the title, which is Dark Sisters, right? Who are the Dark Sisters? They are this ghostly pair of women who are sort of tied together by the same braid. So the braid sticks out of one's head, goes into the other.
They're the antagonists in the story.
They're sort of like this ghostly presence around a supernatural walnut tree that exists in the same space that all these generations visit. And that's kind of where the curse originates, the curse being the origin of this weird mouth sickness that descends on women who suppress themselves. So you kind of get the idea, right? And so with all of these podcasts, right, we speak to the author, and Christy DeMeester came into GPB Studios to chat with me about Dark Sisters, and I asked her about the origin of Dark Sisters.
So Dark Sisters, as an entity, originated actually in a manuscript for a very different novel that I was initially writing. And even within that novel, they were meant to be this symbolic encapsulation of women when they are subjugated to a point of not being able to live to their fullest selves. And I ultimately went away from that novel strictly because after a very frank and candid conversation with my very lovely agent, she told me, I don't think I can sell this book right now. The market is just overly saturated. And as I went away from that, I realized I couldn't abandon the idea of what the Dark Sisters were meant to say. And so as I started to consider what other ways and in how, what other kinds of stories can I use exactly what it is that they represent.
And so she went back to the drawing board, essentially, and was thinking about her own upbringing, her own interactions with Christian communities growing up. She was thinking of the overturning of Roe v. Wade. And because of all those things, she couldn't abandon this idea, and she came up with this idea.
So we've got Roe v. Wade, okay, which is in
not
our
mentioned
life.
In the book, we should say. We got just the inspiration,
so,
at least
we got
in part.
Stuff within our lifetimes. We've got stuff in the 1700s, mm-hmm. and you mentioned even one more timeline. So how did all these timelines weave together?
Yeah, well, let's talk about them, right? Because the chapters sort of alternate. So you focus on one woman and then another and then another, and you can start to see the through line in all their lives. But we'll start chronologically and say 1700s, it's a woman named Anne Bolton. She is kind of a healer. She's connected to the earth. She creates her own medicines. And she's living in a Christian society that it's not Salem, but there is something of a witch hunt happening here, and women keep being put to death because they're suspected of being witches. And so this woman, Anne Bolton, she has an adult daughter, and she kind of tricks her daughter into convincing her daughter to run away from that community to save their lives, because she believes that she's going to be targeted next, and she's not wrong about that. So as she leaves, she kind of makes an oath with that magic walnut tree we're talking about, and that's...
How do you make an oath with a Walmart tree? Walnut tree, do you raise your right hand and swear to the walnut tree?
Cut your hand first. And
oh,
then touch
my
the tree.
Goodness.
Okay, so maybe there's a little more gore that I wasn't planning on talking about. But yeah, like there's some, you know, blood oath stuff happening here. And so they flee this community because Anne is worried that she's going to be killed for being a witch.
I have always been fascinated with the stories of the women in the 1700s and the hypocrisy and the irony that came out of the Salem witch trials, and that women who were considered to be nature-based healers were vilified and considered to be evil or othered. And a lot of the time that wasn't just because they were participating in very anti-Puritan activities, but it had a lot more to do with greed and hypocrisy. Of if you had a woman who was single, whether that be because that was by choice or by circumstance, or it was because she had been widowed, if you had a single woman with land or you had a single woman with money, she had a target on her back because it didn't fit the ideology of the time, but then also it was a really easy path to getting her land or getting her money.
So Anne Bolton is accused of witchcraft. Does she escape this accusation?
Well, that's a spoiler. Can't do that here. But I will say that her flight from that community and what Anne does to make sure her daughter joins her is kind of the origin of that curse I mentioned earlier, and follows the women in the generations to come.
Okay, in the generations to come, do we get in a time portal now? We're going to
yes,
the rocket age.
Through the magic of literature, we're going to the 1950s now. And this is my favorite timeline of the three. Her name is Mary. She's married to a man who seems to love her in the kind of shallow husband of the 1950s way. And she falls in love with a woman. And that this kind of awakens a part of her that she didn't realize she had. And you really feel for her because she's discovering she's attracted to women. That's like one of the least safe things you can do in the 1950s. She'll lose everything if she's found out. And so she's really, really hiding her true self.
And I feel like that 50s timeline is what was happening for a number of women. If you go back and you read any of the studies, like the Feminine Mystique came out at the very end of that era, or that decade, I guess I should say. And all of a sudden, women were waking up to this, oh, it's not just me. This is a system that is keeping me from getting what I want. It's so much bigger than just my immediate family unit, and it's so much bigger than even my immediate community. It goes so much further. And I'm unhappy, not because of who I am, but because of this system that's keeping me here.
So if she wanted to talk about hiding and being repressed, I mean, the 1950s is certainly a good time to do that. Post-war era, everybody's kind of conforming.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, that for me was the most obvious choice of timeline, 1953. I mean, this is the era that I'm thinking of books like The Man in the Gray Flannel Suit by Sloan Wilson, which is all about sort of business conformity for men in particular in that particular book. And then also Patricia Highsmith's The Talented Mr. Ripley. I'm sure you've seen the movie.
The movie, yeah.
Yeah, the books follows it pretty closely. And it's all about identity and slipping who you really are away and then, you know, putting on a mask. So 1950s is pretty ripe for that, I think.
And, you know, you're going to get up to the 2000s, I think, here. And you know, it isn't a more open time now, but there are certainly people and circumstances that have to hide their true selves. So what are we hiding in the 2000s?
Yeah, I wouldn't say that 2007 is, broadly speaking, an oppressive hide-yourself kind of era, but in certain contexts, it can be. And that was believable enough for the part of the story that followed Camilla, who's an 18-year-old. She is the preacher's daughter, and the preacher is not just any preacher. He's like the leader of a cult-like version of Christianity called The Path, where if you don't behave, you are sent to retreat with a capital R, and this retreat is supposed to sort of cleanse you of all the evils and put you
what
back
evils?
On the right path.
Homosexuality again?
In one case of one woman in the story, not the main character in that section, but, you know, adultery.
Okay.
You know, she's having sex with a contractor in her house and you know, gets sent off to retreat because she was misbehaving. And then Camilla, the woman in this particular chapter, she hosts a party that she's not supposed to.
I know people who are estranged from their families. You know, we have the holidays coming up, you know. People are thinking about what are they going to do because they can't go back to, they don't have family to go to.
Because their families have sort of said, you're not conforming to our religion.
Yeah,
you gotta get
religion,
out of here.
Again, sexuality, other politics, whatever it happens to be, they just don't feel welcome at their house. So anyways, how do we weave all of these things together now?
Well, I should say that Mary and Camilla are related. I think if I'm reading this correctly, Camilla is Mary's granddaughter. They don't necessarily have to be related, I don't think, for the curse to work. It seems like the curse is just part of this community.
The curse sort of goes over
everything. Yeah, it's pervasive in this community.
The walnut tree is always there.
The walnut tree is there, and so that's kind of what connects all these women through the generations, even if they're not related, is that they're all suffering to some extent under the pressure to hide their true selves. And that becomes manifested in the horror novel, as horror novels tend to do, sort of exaggerate things and bring them to the surface in a kind of really visceral way. That's what's happening here.
If I could suggest something, I mean, we have this theme of oppression, but we also have a theme of freedom, because there has to be an alternate to it.
The nature of freedom too. And there's actual like discussion, explicit discussion of freedom, especially in the Mary section, the 1950s section, where they're talking about, well, if you can't be seen with me in public, you know, is that really free? Like, yes, Mary and Sharon, they're having their romance behind closed doors and it feels amazing and they're connecting. But if they can't do it out in public, what is this? What are we doing here? So that's part of what Christy DeMeester and I spoke about when she came to GPB Studios.
When you accept that freedom, you have to accept all parts of it. I think that there's this through line through the book of, we really only want to look at the light parts. We really only want to examine the parts of ourselves that we have been told are right, have been told are good. And that's not what we are at the core of ourselves. There's so much more that's we're told to be ashamed of, or that we're made to feel guilty about, and that in order to experience and live a really true life, there has to be an acceptance of all of those things. And that if that acceptance doesn't happen, how do we pay for it? And unfortunately, the women in this book, they pay in really awful, terrible ways.
She says she grew up in a way that made her feel similarly to some of the characters here, so she really couldn't turn away from this idea, even when her agent first suggested it might not be marketable. So, yeah, she really, really committed to this idea for personal reasons.
Well, I'm glad she persisted in getting her book out. It sounds like a great theme, this idea of the curse and the walnut tree and tying it in with freedom and oppression and being yourself. Did you say where the book takes place? Where is this walnut?
It's in Atlanta.
Oh, it's in Atlanta. Mm-hmm. Okay. And what gives the book the narrative edge?
Well, I think the stories of each of the women are compelling in their own way. I think each reader is going to sort of pick which one they think is most compelling to them. For me, it was Mary, just because that felt most visceral to me. But the threat of having your mouth start to rot from the inside out, that was a compelling reason to sort of get ahead of this curse and maybe start to find the courage to express yourself in the face of, pushback from a community, mostly a community of men, but definitely enforced by women to some extent as well. So as you read, you really want the women to sort of overcome this and find a way to, you know, not to borrow a Red Sox analogy, but reverse the curse, and get right with themselves.
Series of magic words, you say, like something you boil in a pot.
That's what you're reading. Well, you're reading to say, geez, I hope they find a solution to this, because this illness that they have seems just like one of the worst things that you could actually physically feel.
Well, I won't ask you to tell me what the solution is. But
yeah, no. But let me tell you one thing before we go. Yeah. This is not related to the book necessarily, but Christy DeMeester and I had a conversation about this, because it's in her bio. It says she makes horror-themed candles. As a craft.
Like, do they like smell bad?
Yes. No. They don't. I mean, I don't know how they smell because I've not smelled them.
Okay.
But she says she makes them sort of inspired by horror movies like Friday the 13th and Halloween. She kind of gets a sense of the vibe of the scent of the movie and sort of creates them that way. And so I did ask her about what she would put in a Dark Sisters scented candle, and perhaps walnut, perhaps bergamot. She mentions bergamot a lot in this book. So anyway, I just thought that was fun to mention, because as a writer, and we talked a little bit about this as well, when you write something, it's usually on a computer, right? You don't even see a stack of papers at the end of the day. You put all this work in and there's like nothing to physically show for it. So she wanted something.
She's got merch now.
Yeah, she's got merch. Well, yes. So she wanted something to show for a day's worth of effort. And we talked about it and she said, oh no, I don't have any ready in my store. And I said, well, this, you know, you got a couple of weeks before we broadcast this.
And we got a couple of weeks towards Christmas. We can get some gifts. So, all right. The book is called Dark Sisters by Christy DeMeester. Thanks for telling me so much about it.
Happy to.